The legislative session wraps with a flurry of smoked-out bills and big projects for South Dakota's future. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Monday, March 15th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Seth Tupper looks at efforts to change the state's process for a direct democracy, and Lee Strubinger joins us for a recap of the final days of the session, including difficult decisions for Governor Kristi Noem in the days ahead. Then Dr. Shankar Kura is with us for a look at COVID in South Dakota. We'll talk about a new variant confirmed in the state. We'll also talk about the rising infection numbers, whether or not South Dakotans are sticking to those virus countermeasures. We also take a look back at the beginning of the Pick Sloan plan and at the influence of Civil War soldiers in Dakota Territory. Plus, Nate Weck has the stories of the state basketball tournament. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. The National Park Service has denied South Dakota officials' request to launch fireworks at Mount Rushmore this year. National Park Service Regional Director Herbert Frost denied the state's request, saying the Park Service is concerned about risks to the park and employees after a fireworks show at the monument last July during a campaign appearance by then-President Donald Trump. Frost also says the service's tribal partners expressly oppose fireworks at Mount Rushmore. They say large crowds the event would draw would make social distancing difficult, if not impossible. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld the conviction of Timothy Burns, one of two men who defrauded investors in a proposed fish and hydroponic vegetables farm near Brookings. At oral arguments in October, the U.S. attorney laid out a daring scheme that started in 2016. Victoria Wicks has this report for SDPB.
At oral arguments, U.S. Attorney Ron Parsons says Timothy Burns hired two salesmen to pitch global aquaponics and South Dakota food security to potential backers. And so the salesmen conducted angel investor meetings and relayed what they had been told. $5.6 million had been raised, the land had been secured, and contracts had been signed with distributors to sell fish and produce.
They told people we already own the land. They had a groundbreaking. State Attorney General was there with a shovel. They didn't even own the land. That was a lie.
When the salesman grew suspicious and demanded documentation, Burns falsified an email claiming there was $1.5 million in cash on hand, more than $2 million paid toward the greenhouse structure, and almost $2 million paid for equipment. Burns wrote in the email that he was looking at a balance sheet while writing. Parsons tells Eighth Circuit judges that Burns testified at his trial that he knew he was lying when he wrote the email because he didn't know what the financial situation was, but he relied on information given to him by his co-conspirator.
He says, well, I assumed that we did have this $5.6 million. That was his testimony. He said, I thought we had it. So he either knew they didn't have it and created those lies to satisfy the investors and the salesmen, or he said, I don't want to know if we have it or not, so I'm going to create these lies to satisfy the investors and the salesmen.
In its opinion, the Eighth Circuit says the U.S. attorney had more than enough evidence to convict Burns of wire fraud. The Eighth Circuit says Burns was Global Aquaponics' chief operating officer and general contractor. He managed day-to-day operations and had access to the accounts. At best, Burns knew facts existed and deliberately avoided learning them. At worst, he was a full partner in the fraud. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
The state may impose new restrictions for hunters disposing of deer and elk carcasses. Hunters would need to put the remains in a garbage container or drop them at a permitted landfill. The Game, Fish, and Parks Commission is considering the requirement to prevent the spread of chronic wasting disease. The disease is fatal for deer, elk, and moose. Wildlife Program Administrator Chad Switzer says the new rule would apply to any animal killed in the state, regardless of whether it comes from a county with chronic wasting disease or CWD.
We want to implement regulations that are proactive versus right now we're being very reactive to our regulations to reduce the spread of CWD. As new areas become detected or confirmed with CWD, we are constantly have changing expectations on our hunters the way our rules are currently written.
Switzer says the rule also applies to taxidermists and meat processors. The GFP Commission wants public comment on the proposal before its April meeting. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota legislature has passed several measures pushing back on the state's initiative and referendum process. A Democratic lawmaker calls the legislation an attack on direct democracy. But at least one Republican says ballot measures should be attacked. SDPB's Seth Tupper has more.
The state legislature holds the primary power to make laws.
However, the people expressly reserve to themselves the right to propose measures which shall be submitted to a vote of the electors of the state, and also the right to require...
Democrat Reynold Nessaba of Sioux Falls read that language from the state constitution during a recent speech on the Senate floor. He wanted to remind his colleagues that the people have the right to make laws too. They can gather thousands of petition signatures to put a proposed law on the ballot. That's called an initiative. Or they can petition an existing law onto the ballot for repeal. That's a referendum. State residents have had those rights for 123 years. In fact, South Dakota was the first to authorize statewide initiatives and referendums. In recent years, Democrats have used the approach to enact laws they couldn't get passed in the Republican-dominated legislature. Voters have approved Democrat-backed ballot measures to legalize marijuana, stiffen anti-corruption laws, cap interest rates on short-term loans, and raise the minimum wage. Nessaba says Republicans are now fighting back with legislation to make it harder for voters to make and change laws.
The Republican Party is engaging in a systematic attack on the initiated measure and initiated constitutional amendment process.
Republican Representative Steve Haugard of Sioux Falls acknowledges he doesn't like it when citizens make their own laws.
We've started out as a republic. Sadly, we're tending in the direction of a democracy. And that democracy was only intended to be going to the polls to vote for your elected representative.
Haugard called the state's 1898 authorization of initiatives and referendums sad.
It's become a way that certain interest groups can get things accomplished outside of the legislative process. And I think that does great damage to our republic.
Other Republicans say their goal is to improve the initiative and referendum process. Several of their bills have passed both chambers. One proposal would change the threshold to pass a ballot measure. Instead of a simple majority, any ballot question that raises taxes and fees or spends more than $10 million would require a 60% majority to pass. Republican Senator Lee Schoenbeck says he wants to prevent outside groups from using South Dakota as a laboratory for costly ideas.
This comes to us so that we can have one more protection built into our election process. If groups come, seems like these days they're mostly not from here, and if they want to put a tax increase on our ballot or they want to spend over $10 million, they have to get a 60% vote.
But Democratic Senator Reynold Nessaba says this isn't just about taxes and spending. He says Republicans want to make it harder for citizens to pass a ballot measure.
It's darn hard to put a measure on the ballot and to get it passed. And if there's any protections that need to be done today, it's about protecting the rights of our citizens, of your constituents, to go out with an idea, to gather signatures, and to put it on the ballot. That's what needs protections. We've been eroding it all session.
Republicans need voter approval to increase that voting threshold, so they're sending it to voters in June 2022. Nessaba says the timing is clear.
That's just a preemptive strike against Medicaid expansion.
Nessaba says Republicans want the higher threshold in place before Democrats petition Medicaid expansion onto the ballot in November 2022. Citizens will decide that measure, but two other bills have passed the House and Senate and wait for the governor's signature. One involves the official explanation needed for ballot measures. Petitioners have to obtain that short explanation from the Attorney General's office before they can start gathering signatures. A bill approved by the legislature would establish a new 20-day public comment and revision period after the Attorney General publishes the explanation. Republican Senator Mike Diedrich says the waiting period will produce a better result.
This allows a little more input into the process to make sure that that explanation is clear.
But Nessaba says it robs groups of time they need to circulate petitions.
The main effect of this, whether it was intended or not, the main effect is simply to make it harder to put measures on the ballot. So if you want to make it harder for South Dakotans to bring redress of grievances to their government and put something on the ballot, then vote for this.
Nesiba says another bill that sounds innocuous will also make circulating petitions more difficult. That bill requires at least 14-point font for the text on petitions. Republican Senator Al Novstrup says the font on petitions for last year's medical marijuana initiative was too small.
When I sat down and was going to attempt to read IM 26, I was unable to do that. And as I looked at it, I believe, in my opinion, that the font size was maybe size 6. And I was just unable to read it. And I would estimate that approximately half of South Dakotans were unable to read that particular font size.
But Nesiba says there's an existing problem that the font size bill exacerbates. Current state law says the full petition text and signature lines must be on a single sheet of paper. For more complex proposals, Nesiba says petitioners have to print long sheets of paper and fold them up like an accordion.
Simply increasing the font size on a giant piece of paper that's folded up multiple times and on a clipboard is not going to help anybody. It's just going to make that beach towel-sized petition become a little closer to the size of a bed sheet.
Nesiba tried to change the bill. His amendment would have allowed petitioners to carry two sets of paper, one with the short explanation and signature lines, and another with the full proposal in 14-point font on regular-sized paper. His amendment was rejected. The font size bill and the comment period bill are both awaiting the governor's signature. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper.
Find all our news stories online at sdpb.org/news. More from the legislative session after a break on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
With COVID-19, stock market volatility, and a recession in the offing, the news right now can be unsettling to say the least. But during these disquieting times, Marketplace remains committed to bringing you necessary daily economic context. So please join me, Kai Rizdahl, every weekday to make sense of what's going on in U.S. markets and in the global economy.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Yak Ridge Cabins and Farmstead. Your year-round Black Hills adventure awaits with private cabins, modern amenities, and Himalayan yaks. Social distance stays minutes from Mount Rushmore and Hill City. More at yak-ridge.com.
From the Big Sioux and Big Stone Lake to the Buttes and Badlands, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is bringing people together, creating events, telling stories, building community. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Listen for information about our Sound Vision campaign coming in April.
Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The 2021 legislative session in Pierre wrapped up regular business with a flurry of smoked-out bills and details of record-setting appropriations made possible in part by the influx of federal money into the state coffers. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reported on the session from Pierre. Today, he joins us for a recap of the final days, and he's joining us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio. Lee, welcome back.
Hey, Lori. Good to be here.
Let's talk about last Monday and why that day was such a defining day in the state legislature this year.
Yeah. So, you know, by now, as you've said in the intro, and maybe listeners have already heard of this legislative maneuver, it's called a smokeout. And it's a process by which one third of either members of the House or Senate can vote to have a committee bring down a bill to their respective floor after it was rejected in a committee. And last Monday in the Senate, there were four smokeouts, but three major ones that occurred. And real quick, here are the three bills. One would rewrite the state's use of force laws to make them almost identical to Florida's. It makes the standard ground law similar to Florida. And proponents of the bill say Florida's a reason for the law, saying there hasn't been any major problems in that state with it. Recall several years ago, that's something that George Zimmerman's legal defense has leaned on, claiming self-defense for the shooting of Trayvon Martin in 2012. The standard ground law was rejected 4-2 in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Another bill was one that was proposed by Governor Kristi Noem, and it would have restricted entry of conservation officers onto private land. And we've covered that bill quite a bit this year. That was rejected in Senate Judiciary 7-0. And then finally, there was the Fairness in Women's Sports, which was rejected 6-3 in Senate State Affairs. It got smoked out as well. You know, so all of that's to say that these bills were not rejected in committee by a slim margin.
Yeah. So what does that mean from a procedural standpoint?
Yeah. So Democratic State Senator Troy Hiner was frustrated on the Senate floor that day. And then later on in the week, he said he's generally fine with the smoke out process. I think every legislator is. But this year, Hiner says he was troubled by the content of the bills that did get smoked out on Monday. And he says the Senate should be more cautious about what gets to the floor.
Usually a smoke out is used if, you know, a member was absent or if there was a change that needed to be made. These were just, you know, smoke outs because they didn't like the result of the committee process.
Republican State Senator Gary Kamak was one of the main proponents of the governor's bill restricting conservation officers. You know, despite his success in getting that bill to the governor's desk, ultimately he says smokeouts should be used with caution.
It ended up that there were some bills that people felt strongly enough that they wanted a second opinion from the floor, and that's how it worked out.
So, Lee, all of this is important, especially when you have a committee rejecting something 7-0 and then it getting smoked out. But it's ultimately also interesting because it led up to a key moment that somehow intersected with medical marijuana in the Senate. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so last Monday was the last day that either the House or the Senate could vote on bills. So they had a big, long list of bills they needed to consider. And they did those smokeouts early on in the day. And then about halfway through their calendar was the governor's delay to the medical marijuana, voter-approved medical marijuana initiative, also known as IM-26. The Senate took the governor's bill and they added amendments that would decriminalize possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
All right, so why would they do that? Because... Yeah, explain that to me.
Yeah, sure.
Did they think the House, so then it has to be approved by the other chamber as well. Did they think that that was something the House would go along with?
Depends on who you ask. There was some chess being played there, you know. So the House's bill delayed implementation of IM-26 until January 1st of 2022. And also after an interim committee would have gotten the chance to take a look at it and how it would affect the state and state law and stuff like that. The Senate was fine with that delay, but they just added in the amendment decriminalizing pot. Republican State Senator Blake Curd brought the amendment, and here's what he had to say about it.
It allows the will of the people to be said and heard, at least to some degree, but it also gives the Department of Health time to develop the robust medical marijuana treatment program that they have stated to us on numerous occasions that is their desire to do so.
Obviously, the House rejected those amendments. We do not... marijuana decriminalization is not on the horizon, at least for now, because Amendment A is held up in the courts. But so what happened was the two chambers came together. They failed to meet an agreement. So the bill delaying the implementation of IM-26 died in the legislature. And now, after all the jockeying back and forth, initiated Measure 26 will go into effect on July 1st as written.
Just like 70% of the voters said it should. Well, what Correct. About this notion of the governor planning on a special session about medical marijuana?
So she was asked about that during end of the week press conferences last week. And most recently, she says she hasn't thought to call a special session yet. Later on in the day, State Senator Gary Kamak says he thinks the legislature needs to weigh in on it. So time will tell. You know, despite his saying so, it appears that the Senate's kind of dug their heels in on whether changes to IM-26 get made or not.
All right. Time will tell. Now, you've also been covering a couple bills pretty closely that opponents say discriminate against the transgender community in South Dakota. One of them did make it to the governor's desk. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, sure. So the bill in question is one that is to promote fairness in women's sports. It essentially says that girls' high school and college sports are reserved for biological females. The prime sponsor of the bill, Republican Representative Rhonda Milstead of Sioux Falls, alongside fellow Sioux Falls legislator, State Senator Maggie Sutton, were able to push this model legislation through each chamber. And like I said, it was one of those bills that got smoked out on Monday. It's nearly identical to the one that passed in Mississippi and was signed into law on Thursday. And according to Reuters, there's about 37 some bills regulating transgender athletes that have been introduced in like 20 states this year. And that's being tracked by the Human Rights Campaign. So when the bill passed the Senate on Monday, which happened to be International Women's Day, Governor Kristi Noem tweeted that she was very excited to sign the bill in honor of that day.
So how exactly does this bill work, and how does it keep sports organized in the way that they propose?
So it essentially establishes three different types of sports: boys' sports, girls' sports, and co-ed sports. And then underneath all of that, it says girls' sports are specifically reserved for biological females. So how that would work, though, is it would require that schools collect a written waiver that states every high school and collegiate athlete's age, reproductive biology, and whether they've taken performance-enhancing drugs. And in the case of girls' sports, if a school suspects an athlete is not a biological female, they can reference that waiver and proceed from there.
What does that look like?
I've tried to pin that down. You know, the bill says if there's reasonable cause to suspect the waiver is false or misleading, the athlete will be removed from the team for the year. Proponents really focus on the part about protecting girls' sports. You know, however, if an athlete is removed from a team, the only way they could get reinstated would be going through the courts. So I asked the governor about that, given her support for the bill that she mentioned last week. And here's what she had to say.
Can I ask a few questions? What you've talked about with 1217 is more generally like Section 1, but further on down in the bill, there are some other things that I had questions about. Do you think it's appropriate that kids should have to go to the courts to essentially prove their genitalia just to get reinstated on a sports team?
Well, in South Dakota, in regards to this legislation, it reflects birth certificate.
It has schools collect a written waiver that basically is somebody writes down like what their reproductive biology is, and then the courts would look at that, or schools would keep that on file. Is that the appropriate role of government?
Well, I won't weigh in on what each individual school district may decide and what the court system process would be.
But that's what the bill said, and you said you were excited to sign the bill. Do you think that is the appropriate role of government?
I think in regards to this piece of legislation, we're evaluating that, and we'll move forward based on that evaluation that I put every bill through.
A report from Lee Sturbinger. You can find all our legislative coverage on our website at sdpb.org/news. Lee, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Good to be here, Lori. Thanks.
A new variant of COVID-19 has been detected in the state, and the state's infection rate has seen a slight increase in recent days. Are South Dakotans claiming victory over the virus a bit too soon? We've got Dr. Shankar Kura next. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, we speak with Deborah Feldman, whose memoir about leaving the ultra-Orthodox Satmar Hasidic community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, inspired the Netflix series Unorthodox. Feldman will explain why she felt she had to leave her arranged marriage and the price she paid for breaking with the sect. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. 50,000 miles of resilient broadband fiber supporting online banking and other essential businesses right where you need it. More at SDNCommunications.com.
Michael Deese didn't take up the trombone until he was 17. 9 months after switching from saxophone, he entered Juilliard's inaugural 2001 jazz class. Today, he's one of jazz's premier trombone soloists. On his new album, Give It All You Got, Deese digs into the sounds of hard bop. I'm Carl Gerke, and we'll hear tracks from Deese's latest on the next Jazz Nightly New Music Monday, along with new releases from pianist Michael Wolff, singer Rebecca Dumain, and others. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Department of Health reported 3 new deaths from COVID-19 on Sunday. This virus is not done taking its toll on our lives and on our loved ones. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. He's joining us with our weekly COVID-19 update. Dr. Kura, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. A pleasure always.
I want to start by talking about some of our mitigation measures or COVID-19 countermeasures and what you're seeing with the trends of new cases. Are we starting to head in the wrong direction?
The answer is not yet. So that is relative good news, but it can head in the wrong direction. The main thing to understand is, as far as transmission dynamics are concerned, that has not changed. So in other words, any of the new variants, and there are several of them right now being identified in the United States, and you know, just a fun fact is they're naming them after birds, just so it's easier to kind of refer to them than using the lineage. I mean, the scientists use the lineage, to describe that, but using birds. But what I was trying to say was we still need to do all the things. Those basic things are going to stop regardless of what the variant is. So to answer your question, we're not seeing a alarming rise in numbers. And one good example is Florida, the state where, you know, because they're doing a lot of sequencing where they're finding this UK variant. But the good news thus far is their numbers haven't taken a sharp upturn as you would expect if this were a fast spreading variant. So given all that, what it shows is doing the right things to stop the virus, the non-pharmaceutical interventions, which is the face masking, distancing, hand washing, not gathering crowds, and additionally, the race against time to get at least 80% of the population vaccinated. That's where we need to focus.
All right, which birds have migrated to South Dakota? What have we found here as far as variants so far?
So the one that the South Dakota, the only one is the UK variant. So the 3 variants that, you know, have come at least to international attention are the United Kingdom variant, the Brazilian variant, and the South African variant. And those don't have bird names because that's, originally that's how they were identified. Even though we use the geographical term in front of the variant, that doesn't mean that's where they started. No one knows where they started. But anyway, the UK variant is what we're seeing in South Dakota right now. And if you look at the map, and I have a colored map in front of me, the surrounding states of North Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska, Iowa, and Montana, they all have the UK variant as well, as you would expect, because it can't just be in one place. It's spread from abroad and spread across the United States. The only state that stands out is Colorado, which has both the UK and the South African variant. So what it actually means is that in all likelihood, all three variants I just named, international, Brazilian, South African, and UK, are present in South Dakota. And that is not to sound alarming. What I mean by that is the mathematics and the epidemiology clearly indicates that these variants are across the country. We don't do as much sequencing, and we have started since the beginning of this year more sequencing to give an idea. Our eventual goal, the United States, is to sequence at least 25,000 a month. We are, we kind of are about 7,000 a month. And they come from some of the bigger states because they have the ability to either a university setting to do it or send it to a central lab. Places such as ours, the mountain states, we don't have as many numbers that we sequence.
So if you're tested and somehow your test gets selected for sequencing, are your isolation requirements any different than if you have the, original SARS-CoV-2?
Yeah, the answer is no. You do not have any special requirements. So let's start there. I love the question you just asked, Lori, because, the plague of COVID-19 is caused by the ancestral strain that, as it multiplied, evolved and made mistakes. And so that's what these variants are. So the three we always talk about got notoriety because of the sequencing efforts of the United Kingdom, South Africa, and that's how it is. But right now, because we're doing a lot more sequencing in the United States, there are at least five or six others that are similar in having a certain specific mutation called the EEK mutation, E484K. They kind of humorously call it the EEK mutation. But, so what it means is these are just small mistakes. And to kind of make it simpler to understand, in no way is the virus new. In no way is it spreading differently. In fact, most of the evidence, at least, is still emerging because we have so little sequencing. Even the UK, with all their sequencing, it's still a very minority of that. So there is not the clear indication that these are different. What we do know from all the evidence is they're no different. So you don't need to do anything special. Let's say you're detected with a variant. You don't need to do anything special for it. And best of all, the real-world data that's coming from the vaccination, especially the large study in Israel of the Pfizer-BioNTech, clearly shows it effective against these variants. We're talking about 95%. And the same with the other vaccines, other two. That is even more impressive because the trial data is one thing because it's a small sampling of 40,000 folks. Now you're talking millions, and the data from the real world strongly suggests that these vaccines are effective, and that's the most reassuring. It was just published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, so a lot of reassurances, which is why I can confidently state that you don't need to do anything special. What you do need to do is get the vaccine, so please register, or if someone you know is hesitant, influence them to register, because that's the only way we can get rid of the pandemic, stop the virus in its tracks, and go back to a normal social life.
Let's talk about that vaccine. I'm getting a lot of questions from people about wanting to pick one or the other, even though they don't have that choice yet, because they think one is better for something. So today I was asked, is Pfizer better for people who have already had COVID? So my first question to you is that true? Is there any evidence to suggest if you've already had COVID that there would be a vaccine of choice for you?
The answer clearly is there is no evidence. And the thing about these three trials, the Pfizer-BioNTech trial, the Moderna trial, and the Janssen, which is the subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, these vaccine trials were done at different times, different geographic locations, with different circulating variants. So the Johnson & Johnson trials, they concluded that 85% protection against severe disease. The Pfizer-BioNTech said 95%, and Moderna said 94.5%. The reality is we might be underselling the Johnson & Johnson because the three countries that Johnson & Johnson was tested, United States, Brazil, and South Africa, were in the highest peak of community-based transmission. So in other words, the background rates were super high. Number two, there were variants. We're talking about, for instance, in South Africa, 80% of variants at that time circulating were all the UK variant. And in Brazil, the P2 variant, which is really concerning, is 70% circulating. So what it means is statistically, based on science, the way we parse data, if you took the statistical for each one in different locations, you can't compare, number one. Number two, there is no significant difference at all in all three vaccines. On the contrary, you could make a very strong case that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is equal to all the other two because it is that high in its efficacy despite being trialed in areas where the variants were at the highest percentage.
How are we doing with vaccine acceptance? Secretary Kimmel Samarasinghe was on last week on March 10th, and she said we had reached 70% of vaccinations among people 65 or older already. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing groups of people that are, you know, have a high rate of showing up for vaccines? Are there differences between, I know there's a lot more females that have been vaccinated in South Dakota than males. Is that because all those healthcare workers and teachers kind of showed up and skewed female? Or is that because women are more? Like, what do you know about who's saying yes in South Dakota?
Yeah, if you go with the most recent published survey, second week of February, very clearly there is a generational difference. 65 and older clearly are the ones at most risk. And the pandemic has clearly made a believer out of that group because, you know, you see the numbers, it's staggering. You know, we're close to 90% of deaths are occurring in that age group. So that's one. And it's unfortunate that the age groups that are probably younger, I'm not exactly sure, but somewhere in the 40 and below, are less likely, not in percentages. Obviously, there are folks even in that age group who are going and getting vaccinated, but less likely. And that's a huge part of the vaccine hesitancy right there. And you might be right about the gender as well. But most importantly, I think we are in a struggle here. If you have to get to 80% across the country and across South Dakota, getting those hesitancy out of the population, because folks believe that it's not a big risk for them. But what they're really, what we're really talking about here is how can we stop this vaccine in its tracks, so we can have the virus in its tracks, so that we can return to normal social living. And number two, the pediatric population won't see a vaccine till quarter one of next year. So we, as adults who are able to receive the vaccine, should be the firewall that stops the virus from getting into our kids.
It's time to protect the children. Next.
Yes.
Before we were talking about protecting healthcare workers and saving hospital capacity, and we're slowly starting to shift to thinking about the next group. Yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
And I would add one more to that is, more importantly, sometimes those kind of statements don't make as much sense because we are all selfish. This selfish motive there would be, if the only way we can truly return to a normal social existence where we can go out and enjoy the things we'd like to do in each other's company, is to stop this virus. And the only way to stop it is to get vaccinated.
One quick question before we let you go, coming in from a listener, which is, why can't vaccines be given in a pill form? Why are they in a shot? Any thoughts about why these vaccines are not able to be orally transmitted?
Yeah, there's the technological reasons for that because the, if you notice, we had a vaccine that we could give orally, polio. Now, because the polio virus mainly attaches through gastrointestinal tract, it spread from the mouth into the gastrointestinal tract. It works well that way. In the case of the virus we're dealing with, in order to make it possible for it to be absorbed from the gut and into the bloodstream, it's a larger technological challenge. It's far simpler to introduce into the cells without going through the gastric barriers is through a muscle. And that's why this is designed that way.
Interesting. All right, Dr. Shankarkura, the race for time goes on. Get your shots. Sign up if you're eligible today. Thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate
it. Thank you, Lori. Pleasure always.
Sixty-seven years ago, on March 15, 1954, President Eisenhower sent a signal from the White House to Governor Sigurd Anderson in South Dakota. As the message was received, Governor Anderson threw a switch to bring the first power unit of Fort Randall Dam online. The dam and five others in the Missouri Basin were authorized by the Pick-Sloan Flood Control Act, separate water management projects proposed by William Sloan from the Bureau of Reclamation and Lewis Pick of the Army Corps of Engineers were combined, approved by Congress, and signed into law by President Roosevelt in 1944. Now, Pick and Sloan grew to despise one another as they quarreled over separate interests. The final plan was more of a patchwork than a true compromise. Construction of the dam began in 1946, within sight of its namesake, Fort Randall, an early U.S. Army frontier post. Over the next 10 years, eight power units were built. They have an annual electrical production of 1.7 billion kilowatt hours. Also, more than 21,000 acres of indigenous land were flooded by the Fort Randall Dam, and more than 20,000 acres destroyed by the Big Bend Dam. While the project has managed flooding, provided water for irrigation and municipalities, and generated baseload power, the Missouri also used to dump millions of cubic feet of soil into the Mississippi River every year. The silt eventually reached the Gulf and formed a string of barrier islands. When the dams were completed, the silt was eliminated. The island building stopped, impacting wildlife and leaving Louisiana unprotected from storm surges and oil spills. And siltation, or the buildup of soil sediment near the four river dams in South Dakota, is once again raising concerns of renewed flooding from South Dakota downstream to Missouri. Once again, humans will try to harness the power of the Missouri while balancing the needs of people, wildlife, culture, and the economy. That's a look back at this day in South Dakota history. We'll learn more about the region when Bill Hoskins joins us for Images of the Past. That's next on In the Moment. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Awards season is here. We'll have the latest from the weekend Grammy Awards ceremony. Plus, the nominees for the Oscars are announced. That, and when can you expect to get your money from the latest round of COVID relief? Next time on Here and Now.
Monday at 1 Central, noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
On All Things Considered, meet us beyond the headlines. Hear interviews that give you context on the day's biggest stories, updates on the latest breaking news, opinions from experts, and facts to back them up. You'll hear a lighter side of the news, too. Pop culture, the odd, the quirky, distinct voices from all walks of life. Stories from inside your community and throughout the world. Listen every afternoon from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Throughout the months of March and April, we're looking at the histories of South Dakota's Civil War veterans. They were some of the first white people to homestead and establish permanent communities here. Some rose to prominence in business and politics. Many others lived out their lives in simpler ways, but all of them made an impact on the South Dakota we know today. Bill Hoskins is the director of the Siouxland Heritage Museums in Sioux Falls, and he joins me for today's Images of the Past. Welcome back, Bill.
Hey, Lori. Great to be here.
We are going to talk about Nye Phillips. And I think anybody from Sioux Falls recognizes the name Phillips because there's more than one thing named that. Are they named for Nye Phillips?
Well, actually, they're named for another Civil War veteran, Dr. Josiah Lake Phillips, whose family helped start the town companies in the 1850s. Nye Phillips, though, got here pretty early. He was born in Ohio, in Trumbull County, in 1842. And when the Civil War broke out, he joined an organization called the 125th Ohio Volunteer Infantry. And he started off as a sergeant and was, after a year or so, commissioned as a second lieutenant and worked up. And it's really after the war that he has a very colorful war career. After the war, he wanders a little bit, and in 1868 finds that he hears that a buddy from the Civil War, a guy named Ed Broughton, was at this place called Fort Dakota, and Nye was on his way to a job at Fort D.H. Russell in Cheyenne, Wyoming today, and thought he'd stop off and see his Civil War friend. And when he did, he discovered the Army had abandoned Fort Dakota, and Nye Phillips decided to stay and make his life here. He would be the first Register of Deeds of Minnehaha County and held a variety of other offices, including a trustee of the village of Sioux Falls. He was a city alderman for Sioux Falls, a warden of the penitentiary for a while, sheriff of Minnehaha County. So he did a whole host of different things here in the community.
All right, so I want to go back to what you said about him stopping off and saying that the Army had abandoned this fort. How does he stay? Like, where does he stay? Does he stay at the fort?
Well, yeah, he did. He actually roomed in one of the rooms of the old barracks with a guy named Richard Franklin Pettigrew, who was also early on. And Pettigrew's got a really funny story. He said that they roomed together and that Nye did all the cooking, and he tended to wipe the pans out on his trousers, and Pettigrew saying, well, and that worked fine until it got to be fall. And the grease in the trousers started to stiffen up, and one day Nye just left them standing by themselves under a tree, which is really kind of, you know, a colorful story about the early frontier.
Where is the first time you came across that? I'm like, did he write a letter? Was that in a book? Like, how is that story preserved? Those kinds of stories.
It's in the writings of Richard Franklin Pettigrew, and he wrote a series of articles for a magazine called the Sunshine State in the 1920s, sort of reminiscence of the past. And yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah. When you look at someone like Nye Phillips and all the, you know, positions that he held, whether it's the warden or the sheriff, but also the political and religious leadership, what kind of an impact does someone like that make when they come to a place that is a really new to them community and that they're trying to build? So I mean, it seems like these individuals have outsized influence because they're early, they're first to them, of course.
During the Civil War, he had actually served as his regiment's adjutant. That's the guy who does all the paperwork and takes care of making sure everything works for the regiment. And so I kind of think he was used to that type of role as he got here to Sioux Falls, and they needed a register of deeds. They needed a county clerk. They needed someone to be on the council. And I think it was just the normal thing for him to step up and take some of those responsibilities.
Yeah. Bill Hoskins is director of the Siouxland Heritage Museums in Sioux Falls. You can find this story and more images of the past posts on our website at sdpb.org. And do stop by the museum, because these stories in the exhibits are just really peppered throughout with the great interpreters and docents and the great written interpretation as well. So, Bill, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure. Have a good day.
This year's state high school basketball championships were a return to the hardwood after a year of pandemic disruption. SDPB's Nate Weck was there, and he joins us now for a recap. Nate, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori, how are you today?
I am great, and I'm looking forward to talking to you, because you always bring not only, you know, the results, which most of us know by now, but some of these great stories of these great players. Where do you want to begin?
Well, so first of all, I guess I wasn't here for the B-Girls event. With that being said, I do also pay attention to the other two tournaments that did take place as well. I think the biggest place to probably start, I guess, on my end, is probably the biggest takeaway that I had from this weekend, and that was Kaylin Valandra-Prue of White River. She was a senior this year. Last year, she tore her ACL. I believe it was at a January event in Mitchell. So this was kind of her comeback event, and it was, you know, it was a year where I think there was a lot of buzz all season about the White River girls team, but I don't know if anybody really considered them to be the top team. I knew going into it, I was like, it'll be really fun to watch Kaylin Valandra-Prue, because coming into it on Wednesday, she was number 11 on the all-time girls basketball scoring list in South Dakota. So we knew that there was going to be, you know, we're like, well, if she gets this many points, she'll move into the top 10. If she gets like a few more after that, she'll move to top 9. So we knew that there was going to be some movement on that list and stuff like that to see how far she could go. We figured she'd maybe be able to get as high as 7. But we kind of figured that 7-8 range would probably be good, because if you go to the state tournament, you're guaranteed 3 games either way. Win or lose, you're going to be guaranteed 3 games at the state tournament. So she ended up moving into the top 9 spot during the quarterfinal round, and then she ended up moving up to, by the time the tournament was done, she moved up to number 8 on that all-time scoring list with 2,536 points. I've been saying it. I feel like for the last 48 hours, because it's kind of true. But yeah, it's one of those things that was just kind of ingrained in my mind, where it's 2,536 points. That's how Kaylin Valandra-Prue finished her high school career, and what a better way to do it as well for White River and for her and her teammates, because White River also won the girls state basketball championship in Class B. And, you know, the boys there have had success at White River. The boys, those boys teams, you know, you look at the Louis Krogman era. That's a big name that everybody on the basketball that's involved in basketball will recognize, you know, King Louis type of thing. And so everybody kind of knew that White River had success on that boys end, but it was really cool to see not only them get to the state championship game for the first time since 1992, but then to also win and have their first ever girls basketball title, and to see some of the players just play phenomenal. And it was a lot of fun, Laurie, and I think it was one of those performances that I certainly will remember for a very long time.
So Kaylin Valandra-Prue of White River, she ends up at number 8 all-time South Dakota girls high school scoring list. Who does that put her in the stratosphere of?
Yeah, so she finished 5 points shy of Siouxland Big Crow of Pine Ridge. So she's, you know, Siouxland Big Crow is one of the biggest, if not the biggest name, when it comes to girls basketball in the state of South Dakota, just because of her story. I mean, they give out the Spirit of Sioux Award every state tournament event that is in honor of Siouxland Big Crow. So, you know, I think, you know, I had an opportunity to go up to Kaylin right afterwards, and I wanted to get a couple quotes from her. So I went up to her and I said, Kaylin, you finished number 8 on the all-time scoring list, 5 points behind Siouxland Big Crow. And she had to take a breath, and you could just see her eyes welling up. And it meant so much for her to be in that conversation that it's, I mean, it's,
I mean, then she, of course, goes back to, you know, reverts back to, you know, well, if without my teammates, you know, I'm not going to be able to score because they, you know, they're feeding me the ball. You know, they're taking defenders with them as well, which opens things up for me to do things as well. So she was very humble from that aspect. But you could tell that it meant a lot for her. You know, White River is a team that does have a strong native culture, and you know, with Sven Big Crow being from Pine Ridge, it meant so much to her, and I think it means a lot to a lot of people that follow Kaylin. I think it does mean a lot to them, and I was pretty pumped for her, just watching her reaction to see that she was just that close to Sven Big Crow, and she's forever going to be 5 points behind Sven Big Crow, no matter what happens. She's always going to be right there, right next to her.
Right there.
So I thought that was
pretty And Sue Ann Big Crow couldn't score without her teammates either. So fair enough, Kaylin.
Yep.
She did not play on a team by herself. All right, just about a minute left.
You never see a one-man team out there, so that's always...
Nope. 1 minute left. I got to mention those Washington Warriors.
Yeah, they got the victory at the Pentagon, and I was a little bit... you know, trying to figure out what was going on in the double A's, because we saw both the 2 seed and the 3 seed get beat in the quarterfinal round on Thursday night, you know, Aberdeen Central and Harrisburg. You know, I was like, one of these is going to probably be playing Washington potentially, or maybe even O'Gorman here. I didn't really know what to expect out of that Stevens squad, because, you know, they did really well against a Harrisburg team in the quarterfinals, and then beat Brandon, who looked really good in the quarterfinals against Aberdeen Central. So, yeah, Washington got that win. And then also Aberdeen around Cali, they got their first ever state girls basketball championship at the A tournament, too. So what a way to kick off the state basketball tournaments being back.
All right, boys are next.
Yep, boys are coming up this week. We got B boys in Aberdeen, A boys in Sioux Falls, and the double A's are going to be out in Rapid City.
Nate Weck, thanks so much.
All right, thanks, Laurie.